wear it out, make it do or do without. We can't pay for the things you want to buy. Wear your old faded jeans, they are patched but they are clean. Walk proud, my son, hold your head up high.
Hey, good morning and welcome to a Red River Radio Spotlight. I'm Bill Beckett, the program director for Red River Radio. And coming up tomorrow, Saturday, October 16th at 2 p.m., the Louisiana Folklife Commission marks the 7th annual Folklife Month, a celebration of the state's living tradition bearers and individuals who sustain them, and honoring folk crafter Elvin Shields as one of this year's Louisiana tradition bearers. This will take place at the Louisiana Sports Hall of Fame in Natchitoches. And joining me now in our Knoll Foundation studios are Dr. Shane Rasmussen, a professor of English at Northwestern State University and director of the Louisiana Folklife Center, along with Elvin Shields, one of the honorees himself. Welcome, guys.
Thank you so much.
So, Elvin, you know, I didn't grow up as a sharecropper's son. I'm pretty much from middle-class white Ohio. And one of the things you do is you share with children and tourists who come to the plantation and come to the U.S. parks what it was like growing up like that. So can you share that with me as if I was a five-year-old child?
Okay, well, the first thing I want to do with you is to, most people have no idea what a plantation is.
Right.
Okay, so I brought and I gave to you a definition of a plantation.
Mm-hmm.
The first definition I have of the plantation is from Webster's New World Dictionary. An area growing cultivated crops. That's it.
Seems simple, but not accurate.
The second one is the American Heritage Dictionary. A large estate or farm on which crops such as cotton, tobacco, and sugar are grown and harvested, often by resident workers.
Yeah, that also somewhat inaccurate or inaccurate.
Well, this is the one I like best. Yeah. It's from one of my favorite authors, Lyle Saxon, and he said it in his 1927 book, Father Mississippi. A little community comprising of 4,000 acres of land, peopled with 6 or 8 white folks and 360 Negroes. In this world, as many feuds, excitement, heartburning, fights, accidents, as in any part of any city. That's a plantation based on Lyle Saxon.
And remembering that before 1865, those 360 Negroes were not free people.
No, they were slaves.
Right, exactly. But, after 1865.
Well, sharecropping was the next phase of slavery.
Right.
That's all it was.
Because you're attached to the land, and often you owe constantly, so you're constantly indebted. So that is the debtor's trap that plantation life would create later on, would it not?
Yeah, simply because some of the plantation owners, they would allow their slaves to be quasi-married in order to keep the men there.
Right.
Otherwise, if you have 5 or 6 kids with this woman, less chances that you're going to run away.
Mm-hmm.
So then you get 6, 7, 8 kids with her. So you were trapped. So after 1865, what happened was a massive amount of black sharecroppers, ex-slaves, migrated to the north to find it was worse than ever. Because if you've got 5 or 6 kids, the only skills you have is farming, where are you going to Detroit for? So a lot of them wandered back. My family stayed, and we became sharecroppers. And I was born in 1948 into sharecropping. And it's typical. You work from sun to sun, 5 days a week, and Sunday, you know, you're off. But with sharecropping came a contract. You agreed to work so many acres of land, you agreed to, you know, plant it, hoe it, harvest it, and at the end of the year, you was promised half the crop. But if you didn't have mules, you didn't have plows, you didn't have a wagon, well, you had to pay for that. So that was deducted from your share. So your half share became a third.
Mm-hmm.
And if you used the company store, it became even less. But in this deal contract, you had a 600 square feet cabin, exactly the same cabin you were in as a slave, dirt floors, and you had about a half an acre to grow a garden, raise a few pigs, raise some chickens. And if you'd done that successfully, you didn't go to the company store that much. So the mother would buy flour in 25-pound sacks, and some of the companies made those flour, put the flour in a floral, nice sack with flowers on mm-hmm. it. So the mother made the daughters dresses out of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the boys, you know, you had the brogan shoes, and you had the overalls, and you had to get that from the company store. So that's all you got out of it. But year after year after year, you broke even, as they would say.
Yeah.
I don't know what that means, breaking even.
It means you're poor and you're going to stay poor.
And you're going to stay poor. So basically, the owner of the land would say, okay, we broke even this year. You want to do another crop? That means instantly you had to borrow money for winter,
mm-hmm.
and you had to borrow money for seeds. You see how that worked?
Mm-hmm.
So you're going deeper and deeper and deeper. But if you got 8 or 9 kids, no other skills, that's what you had to work with.
Right.
And keeping the family together was a way of life back then. You went to church on Sunday, you went to the field on Monday, and you stayed there until Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a life. You didn't make any money, but you got to hunt and fish and raise a garden and raise... If you'd done the things that you should have done, like raise a garden, can the vegetables, can fruit. There were trees growing everywhere, mm-hmm. bearing fruit. Raise a few pigs, smoke some meat. And that was all about feeding the family. You went hunting. You had rabbit traps. You fished a lot. And that kept you out of the company store. So that allowed you to have a few dollars
mm-hmm.
to buy your kids some school clothes. For sharecropping kids, school started in December after the crops were in.
Mm.
And all the other kids was in school starting September.
Right.
But we showed up, and the only thing we had basically to motivate us, the parents say, you got an opportunity now to learn something. Unless you want to continue this life, you better learn something. And of course, we learned.
Yeah, living subsistence like that, you're living hand to mouth.
That's it.
But when you see others not living hand to mouth, literally living in luxury based upon your work, you see something else on the horizon.
Yeah.
And comes 1967, you chose something on the horizon that would get you, or at least help you get out of that. But during the height of the Vietnam War, you joined the military. You joined the Army.
Yeah, I had nowhere else to go except, since I wasn't in college, I didn't even have applied for college mm-hmm. because I had no money to go to college.
Right.
The Army was going to, somebody was going to get me into Vietnam one way or the other.
Right.
Because the draft, we had the draft. And so basically I talked to one of the recruiters. He said, well, look, you can kind of choose a little bit based on your scores. But if you get drafted, you're going to be 100% infantry.
Right.
You're going to carry a weapon into battle.
Out there in the field, right.
Out there in the field. So I chose to join, and my scores was fairly decent, and I went into quartermaster,
mm-hmm.
which turns out to be managing supplies and food service for the Army.
Right.
For a battalion of 550 men, 3 hots and a cot. That was my job.
Now, you served a year over there and then did 3 more here in the States, I think?
Well, I did a year in Germany.
Okay.
And I did 1 year up in Tacoma, Washington, Seattle, Washington mm-hmm. area, and about a year and a half maybe. And then I did about 6 months at Fort Polk.
Okay. So as a sharecropper's son, somebody who had seen nothing but the plantation as a child, all of a sudden you're in Vietnam, you're in Germany, you're in Washington, D.C., you're in Tacoma, Washington. Mm-hmm. That had to be a somewhat eye-opening experience for a young man to see the rest of the world and to see that there's so much more out there.
Well, my greatest experience and surprised me, meeting different people and meeting people that had never heard of the word plantation before, meeting people that had no idea of my background. Because you got to remember, I met people who got stuck in the Army, because I met a lot of young men from the Northeast who had already graduated from Boston College, New York University, but their deferment had ran out. Mm. They had their, some of them had their master's degrees, and they wound up there, okay, you got your master's degree, okay, no more deferments. And it was too late for them to hurry up and get married and get a baby.
Right.
A lot of them jumped up and got married, but they didn't have time to get. If you got a baby, you got a deferment.
Right.
Well, they didn't get the baby. So they wound up in the same place as me. And I'm sitting there going, I barely got out of high school. You here with a master's degree, how you get stuck here? He say, I didn't get a baby. That was the only other deferment he had coming, was a baby.
Right. The game was not played correctly.
No. No. No, the game was most of the plantation kids, farming kids, deep blue-collar kids, they were going to Vietnam anyway.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they didn't have these deferments.
Right.
You know, and it was all about where can you get a deferment.
Yeah.
And a lot of guys joined the National Guard. And that got them a deferment.
Right.
But for us little kids coming from the plantation, your deferment was get on the truck.
Right. So now, as a young man, 5 years old, you started making these twisted wire Tories, which is the tradition that you are being honored for, is the carrying on of an old tradition of making your own homemade toys. How did you first learn as a five-year-old to make twisted wire toys?
Well, I had older brothers and uncles who were passing this down, the tradition. This thing is still going on in Africa today.
Mm-hmm.
Today. They're still making these wire toys. And I did a lot of research on it, and mostly a lot of thought afterward. And I was under the impression, okay, it's a black kid thing from somewhere. No, it was economics. And as I look at all the nations in Africa, the poorest one is the one the kids are still making their own toys, and they're using twisted wire. They go into the dumps, picking up this wire, and they're twisting their own toys. Same thing with us. We were using baling wire back when it was baling hay with wire. Now, it was a soft anneal wire at mm-hmm. that time. And, of course, sitting around, you're looking at the Sears catalog, and you see all these fancy toys, and you better not bring it up to anybody about buying you one.
Right.
So your older uncles and brothers, they sit down and teach you how to twist it and make it. And we made things that we saw every day. We saw tractors, we saw mules, we saw wagons, and we saw people. That's the thing that we learned to do. And my brother, who was one of the greatest, I think, at it, he can't do it anymore. And I told him, I said, do it. No, he said, no, I'm not even going to try. But I left it alone. I did it from about 5 years old until I turned 15. And then I got serious about girls, and I threw it away.
Girls will do that for.
Oh, yeah.
Funny how that works.
Yeah, I threw it away. And not until I retired, came back to Cane River, started volunteering with the Park Service. And a lot of kids were hanging around, and the kids was asking me questions about what did y'all do here, blah, 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 mm-hmm. where'd you get your toys from? Then I thought, wait a minute, there was no Walmart. There was none of these places where you go get all this stuff.
Yeah.
And I say, well, we made our own toys. And one of the 12-year-old boys looked at me as to say, oh, man, you got to be lying, you know. So I say, no, we made our own toys. So after that day, I went home, I thought about it. How would this kid know?
Mm-hmm.
He can pick up toys anywhere.
So probably has a smartphone.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
And I sit there and I say, maybe I should look into this. So I picked up some The only wire we had was 16-gauge steel. Mm. And I went, boy, this is tough. And so I picked up some wire, and I started twisting to see, will it come back to me?
Right.
I didn't think it would. And it came back. It came back like I never put it down.
Hmm.
And I was shocked. So I called my older brother, he's about 5 years older than me, and told him, I'd say, you know, I can still twist wire. And he'd say, I can't. He wouldn't even try. But anyway, I started redoing it, and I started showing it to kids and basically demonstrating and teaching kids how to do it. I had one big disappointment, though. When I was a kid growing up, only boys did that.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing today in these African countries. Only little boys are doing it.
Mm.
So I had all these kids sitting out there in the park, maybe three quarters, I would say 30, say 40, 50% of them were girls. The rest of them were little boys. And as I, you know, gave them all a piece of wire and showing them, I was so disappointed when the girls did a lot better than the boys. I was really hurt, you know. I was saying, wait a minute, I'm not here to teach little girls how to twist wire. And they picked it up quicker, I mean, just than the boys. And I'm thinking, something wrong here. But that's what happened. And then I decided, well, maybe I need to do a better job at this.
Mm-hmm.
But the little boys, you know, the parents sent them down there with their little game things in their pocket.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to play with that.
Yeah.
And while the little girls, they were eager to figure this out.
Right.
And they figured it out. And they were doing it. And they were doing it smiling. And the little boys were struggling with it. And then I said, well, maybe I should make an art out of this and revive this losing thing here. And so I started doing it, putting them together, doing arts and craft shows, showing them to different people. And then I decided, well, this is not going to work. I need to keep this going. So I decided to write a book and basically show all the toys that we'd done and talk about plantation life. So that's what you have, a copy of that book, showing all the toys that we'd seen as a kid.
Yeah.
The kids in Africa, they're seeing different things. That's what they're twisting.
Right.
But twisting wire toys was a thing of extreme poverty. It had nothing to do with race. It's just extreme poverty. You make your own toys.
Well, it also has to do with the power of an imagination of a young child will go beyond the limits of their surroundings.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And that's the beauty in young children is they can see beyond those surroundings. They can see the life come into those twisted wire people and the tractors move and, you know, and we seem to lose some of that with the smartphones where it's all done for you, you know.
Yeah, everything. But, you know, kids today, most of their toys came from, it's coming from somewhere else.
Somebody's making them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mass producing them. And that's all they see. And they play with it for 5 minutes and they toss it.
Yeah.
I have a 5-year-old granddaughter. She's just that way. She played with it for 5 minutes, and she's through with it.
Yeah, and, you know, she's had her fun, you know. But, you know, when your imagination is engaged and you created the world that you're playing in, there's something different about that because you are the creator of that world.
Yes,
yeah. Now, after, you know, you engineer for 32 years, and you end up back at Oakland, how did that happen? What drew you back to the plantation and in your retirement? And then, of course, now you just shared why you want to share this tale. But what drew you into this? What put you back there?
Well, you know, it was Oakland Plantation until the Park Service purchased that area of it, which include every building that came on a plantation.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go to the Cane River Creole National Historical Park, you have everything that's on a plantation. You have the mule barns, you have the sheds, you have the slave cabins, you have the mansion. You got everything in one place.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the Park Service bought it and preserved it, because at the time it was falling apart, put it back together. And so I said, wait a minute, that's my home. And the two slave cabins that's left, I lived in them.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why they're still there, someone lived in them until about 1973 or 1974, because the women who lived in those homes also worked in the big house as maids, washer women, whatever to be done in the big house. The only reason why these two were still standing, otherwise the rest of the 30 or 40 slave cabins were torn down when mechanization came in to plant more cotton.
Right.
So I said, I have to do something. So I talked to the park superintendent, and I asked, I said, what are you going to do with my home? Of course, the big house, you know, it's got all the French furniture and all that. And that's basically what people were coming to see, how the rich live, you know. And the two slave cabins were empty, just sitting over there empty. And as you walk into the park, they say, okay, slave cabin's over there, the big house over there. And people never even look, and they kept going. And I talked to the park superintendent and said, look, we got to do something with my home here. She said, like what? I say, maybe we should furnish it as sharecroppers lived in it. And she said, we don't have any money for that. I said, I'll fund it. She said, yes, we'll do it one day when we can get, you know how the government, you got to get the money, apply for the money, and 5 years later you may get it. I said, no, no, I will do it. I will find the furnishing. I will pay for it. I will put it in, and we'll have a grand opening. But I said, no, we have to do something with this cabin because we need people who come here to see the other people.
To understand that that big house was furnished with all of that by the labor of
by the
other
labor
people.
Of all of
labor, these. Sweat, lives, and death.
Yes. And she agreed. And, of course, she went where she had to go to get the approval because it was not a happy day for a lot of the... See, the trouble with Oakland, there's a lot of family members there living all around it. And they're like, oh, my God, they're going to talk about slavery.
Yeah.
Where a plantation is about slavery.
Right.
And, of course, the Park Service didn't want to talk about that because you got people, black and white, gets emotional and not realizing that if you're black, a plantation is a major part of your history.
Yeah.
And so we furnished it. We had a grand opening in 2012. People came from all over. And the thing that I enjoyed most was to see all the people out there coming to see the former slave cabin, now sharecropper's home, from a lot of places they came. And the granddaughter of the last plantation, who owned the plantation, she was there, and she was shocked because she had never been into a sharecropper's home before. There was no reason.
Right.
And she was shocked because she grew up in the big house, and she was there along with other cousins, and it gave her, educated her to the fact that, okay, so this is how the maids in the big house live. They didn't know that. They had no idea about that. And a lot of people came, and now more and more people come, and it's a big deal.
Yeah.
Because now they say, okay, we're getting a bigger picture. So I decided to stay on also and interpret and talk to them about it. And it's got bigger and bigger. People comes in by the busload from all over the world.
And it's a good educational experience for us to understand that so much of this country was built on the backbone, blood, sweat, and tears of people who didn't necessarily get to share in the prize at the end of the at the end of the game. So you had to go to the military to get out of that and serve your country in that way. That you were able to go to school, get a mechanical engineering degree, and find your way out. But children of the plantation probably didn't have to go put their lives on the line in that sense. Some of them may have, but it wasn't required.
No, it wasn't required unless you didn't get yourself a baby.
Yeah. Well, there is that. Now there is that. The baby conundrum there.
Yeah. That was your last deferment.
Right. Yeah, I know during World War II, we drafted, you know, just about anybody who you could grab a hold of. And World War I, too.
Yeah,
so,
Vietnam was different.
Well, now we're going to get over to Shane here. Shane, this is the seventh year that you've been designating October as your history, you know, the folk history month, folk life month. How did that come about?
Well, I was on the Louisiana Folklife Commission.
Okay.
And I'm actually in my second tenure of service in as a member of the commission now. But really, it was the lieutenant governor who instigated that and was behind that. October is Louisiana Folklife Month, and the idea was that, hey, let's celebrate these tradition bears, these folks that are keeping tradition alive. As you can hear, Elvin is what they call a Louisiana tradition bear because he, in a sense, you know, that culture, that tradition is situated in history, and he's bringing that with him and keeping it alive through, I mean, look what he's doing. He's sharing it with all those kids. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not surprised that many of them find it to be still fun.
And be honest with you, I wish somebody had shared that with me when I was a kid.
Yeah.
You know, we had social studies, and we did learn a lot, but there's so much more that could have been learned that would have opened eyes, I think, you know, for my generation. I was, you know, in school in the late 60s and 70s is when I attended, born in 61, so a few years after you. That would have given me a different perspective.
Well, you know, I first saw Elvin's his toys at the Natchitoches SU Folk Festival, mm-hmm. where he had them on display. Those toys were functional in that they were fun. They served these purposes to give him something to do, to keep him out of trouble, to make do with what he had. All the kinds of aspects of that lifestyle, these toys kind of enmeshed and were this sort of physical incarnation of where he was and who he was at that time. But here he is back in his roots, and he's taking them up again, and he takes up the wire, and he can suddenly do it again. Mm-hmm. It's the making of it that people find to be meaningful, mm-hmm. partially because it situates them right back to where they were when they first took up that tradition, mm-hmm. and the people and the community that made that tradition and sprang it out of.
When you're making these toys now, does your childhood memory come back as far as how fun it was to play with them?
Well, what happens now whenever, I'm not doing it regular now, but I can do it, and I do it, it's like I have to make this one better than the last one.
Okay.
That's the challenge.
So the drive yes, is still there still to be there. Better, to better
I
yourself.
I have to make it better than the last one.
Well, there you go.
And that's it.
So, you know, this is basically brought to us by Lieutenant Governor's Office, the Louisiana Folklife Commission, and also the National Endowment for the Arts, the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, and Louisiana Folklore Society. And they also fund this and make it possible for us to have these events.
Well, Shane and Elvin, I want to thank you for joining me today. That was Dr. Shane Rasmussen along with Elvin Shields. Shane is a professor of English at Northwestern State University and the director of the Louisiana Folklife Center. Elvin Shields is a tradition bearer and an honoree this year in the Louisiana Folklife Tradition Bearers program. Elvin will be honored in the program that takes place tomorrow, October 16th at 2 p.m. in the Louisiana Sports Hall of Fame in Natchitoches. This event is free and open to the public, and you can find more information at louisianastatemuseum.org or by calling 318-357-2492. That's 318-357-2492. This has been a Red River Radio Spotlight, and for Red River Radio, I'm Bill Beckett.
Back in our cornstalk pony days, cornstalk pony, my faithful old friend, I can still feel your spirit as strong as the wind. And somewhere we'll settle up again and ride off into the hay. Back in our cornstalk pony days, somewhere we'll settle up again and ride off into the hay. You listen to him, Dan. He's a devil, not a man, and he spreads the burning sand with water. Oh, water.